House Committee on Rules, Elections, and Public Affairs. Thursday, April 22nd, 1999, hearing room D, 1:30 p.m. or 3:30 p.m. House Committee on Rules, Elections, and Public Affairs. Thursday, April 22nd, 1999. Hearing room D, 3:30 p.m.
Public Affairs Committee to order. And taking things just slightly out of order today, we're going to open a public hearing on HCR 42. Justin Sincere, just give me an update on that, would you please, Mr. Moore?
Mr. Chair and committee members, HCR 42 refers to the people for approval of the authority for the Legislative Assembly to disapprove administrative rules. The subject of rejection approval of administrative rules has been under debate in both assemblies as well as through citizen action groups. There's a concern that administrative rules have the force or effect of law, rules imposed, sanctions, penalties, fines, and other actions to which citizens are subject.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ron Sincere. I'm the state representative for District 22, which is the Gresham Rockford area. Congress Resolution 42 attempts to give the legislature access to administrative rules for review. And as I mentioned to the chair earlier, there are amendments that we'll bring back next week when you hear this bill again. And I'll just give you quickly a sense of what those amendments will do. Is that if there are three complaints on an administrative rule to an elected official, then the legislature will have the opportunity to bring into session a committee that will be able to review those rules and be able to suspend them if they find the need to suspend them, or to affirm them if they find grounds to affirm them. So this will not be an initiative that will require a complete review of all state administrative rules, which would be a prodigious task, but it would give legislators the opportunity to be able to reach these rules when there's been an administrative rule that's clearly creating a problem in any of our public sectors. That is the nature of the specific amendments that will be part of this.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Terry. And colleagues, there are amendments coming to this HCR 42, so if we could hold our questions for now, and then we'll come back to it next week and we can get the amendments before us. I will recess the public hearing on HCR 42 and open a public hearing on HCR 67. Mr. Morgan will give us an update summary.
Mr. Chair and committee members, HCR 67 refers to people to amend the Oregon Constitution with the, quote, none of the above, quote, option as related to election of judges. Prohibits candidate who is defeated from being appointed to the position of judge. The vast majority are judge positions are uncontested, and HCR 67 is a means for citizens to validate or reject candidates for judge.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the record. My name is Ron Sincere, State Representative of District 22. Just briefly on this bill, this is an opportunity for the public to be able to opt for none of the above when it comes to judges. I think it's a practical knowledge that the most difficult positions in any election to get background information on is judges, and this will give people an opportunity to be able to vote for none of the above. There is amendment to this coming as well, and there are people today that will follow me that will speak more completely on it, but it will strike the last line and allow judges to rerun again. So in the administrator's introduction here, where I described the idea of a person who is defeated, would not be able to run again. This would allow that to happen. So again, we'll have amendments to the committee for your consideration.
Thank you very much, Mr. Sincere. I will recess the public hearing on HCR 67, and thank you for coming today. Open a public hearing on HCR 81. Mr. Moore, and while he's doing that summary, would you please, Mr. Representative Merkley, come forward?
Mr. Chair and committee members, HCR 81 authorized a delegation of Oregonians to Washington, D.C. and to the United Nations and New York City to advocate for East Timor. The Portuguese arrived in Timor in the 16th century and the Dutch the 17th century. An island eventually developed to the Dutch West Timor and the Portuguese East Timor. The Dutch transferred their territory to Indonesia in 1949, the Portuguese in 1975. The Timorese resistance movement has been actively fighting Indonesia troops since 1975.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and colleagues, for hearing House Joint Resolution 81 regarding self-determination for the people of East Timor. I've introduced this resolution because, in short, democracy matters. Democracy is good, dictatorship is bad. Their treatment of citizens is good, gross abuse of human rights is not good. When people cry out for the opportunity to assert their democratic rights and to end an era of violent oppression, their cries should not fall on deaf ears. I'd like to give a brief background on East Timor, a little bit of foreign policy history, and observe why now we have a fortuitous opportunity to support democracy in East Timor. East Timor, as noted, is one half of an island north of Australia. For 400 years, it was a Portuguese colony. The people speak Portuguese and practice Roman Catholicism. In 1975, Portugal granted independence. And within days, Indonesia annexed the island and then invaded it. In essence, East Timor has been ruled by the Indonesian military the past 24 years. Civil rights, crudely oppressed. Fully a third of the population has died through armed conflict and starvation. And in short, East Timor has been the stage for incredible oppression, and the East Timorese have been the target. This process continues. Just 2 weeks ago, a group of East Timorese gathered in a church, were forced out of the church and massacred with rifles and machetes. Approximately 30 to 50 people died in that massacre in the town of Laquitza. Now to the foreign policy. In 1975, the U.S. was immersed in extricating itself from Vietnam. And we saw Indonesia as a reliable ally in our resistance to communism. Thus, the U.S. didn't recognize the annexation, but also wasn't vigorously involved in protecting East Timor. Only one nation in the world, Australia, recognized the annexation, but it rescinded that recognition a couple years ago. One can say that, in essence, the U.S. tabled its opposition to wait for a more favorable opportunity to come to the aid of the East Timorese people. And that opportunity is now here through a number of circumstances. First, Indonesia suffered terrible drought. The drought led to terrible forest fires 2 years ago. Indonesia was financially devastated by the Asian economic flu, which was sweeping through Asia, particularly Korea and Japan. By 1998, the currency of Indonesia went into an economic freefall. In the spring, the military dictatorship of Suharto collapsed. And suddenly, you had a new government talking about democracy, and talking about economically rebuilding and looking to the West to help them out. And this created the opportunity we now have. In January, just as we came into session, in fact, I think it was within a few days of filing this resolution, the President of Indonesia, Habibie, shocked the world by saying that Indonesia would allow East Timor to vote on a plan for autonomy within Indonesia. And that if the vote failed, Indonesia would consider letting East Timor go. That's incredible and very welcome news. Indeed, today the foreign minister of Indonesia is meeting with the foreign minister of Portugal under a UN-sponsored effort to define a path for peace and self-determination. Thus, now is the moment when all in the world have the opportunity to encourage the new Indonesian government to follow through on its expressed intent to solicit and honor the will of the East Timorese people. José Ramos Horta, along with Bishop Bellos, drafted a peace plan for East Timor years ago, and in 1996 received the Nobel Peace Prize for that effort. And last Saturday, José Ramos Horta was here in Oregon talking about that effort. I'd like to quote a few of his words from a previous speech in 1998. He says, East Timor stands as a moral test for the new Indonesia if it wishes to gain international respectability. It is a test for the United States as well. Thank you for your past and future support. I am confident that with your help, East Timor will find peace and freedom in a few short years. Colleagues, let the legislators of Oregon be part of peace and freedom in East Timor by lending our voice of support through this resolution. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Representative Murphy. Should we adopt this resolution? Do you have any idea what the fiscal impact is going to be?
There is no direct fiscal impact to the budget. The resolution does invite the governor to use his discretionary funds to send a delegation to Washington and to the United Nations to convey this message. That would, however, is the use of already appropriated discretionary funds, and it would be up to the governor whether or not to pursue sending a delegation. There's no delegation. There is, so how to put it? There's no fiscal impact in the budget of this resolution.
Yeah, it does say shale sand on line 3 of the page 2.
Yes, it is my understanding from Legislative Council that as a resolution, the entire framework is that of an encouragement, but does not require the government to send the governor to send a delegation. That's my understanding.
That's a difficulty we face with our resolution, I'm afraid, actually.
That's right. No force of law.
Are there any idea how many individuals you're talking about here?
Well, in discussions about this, I envisioned a delegation of 1 to 3, possibly. I've talked with Senator Hatfield about whether he'd be willing to join such a group, and he said that he would be, but possibly Senator Hatfield and another person, for one or two or so people. It would be ultimately the governor's choice whom he would like to send.
So if the governor was to fulfill the obligation of this resolution at all, it would be affecting him also.
Yes.
And if he has any discretionary funds, he doesn't
right.
use for fishing trips.
Yes.
Other questions or comments from members of the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Forward today. Review of family recovery efforts. Yes, up close and personal review. We do have two folks from the same organization, East Timor Action Network, Diane Nestling and William Thune. Do you care to come forward together? In the interest of time, we do have to recess at 4:30. We have a function to make it available for members of the committee in the function of the House Chambers today. From 4:30 to 5, we'll recess then and come back at 6 and try to complete our work before 8 o'clock. And I anticipate that we will be able to do that. So just so you know, we will be recessing shortly before 4:30. Proceed. Introduce yourselves to the record.
My name is Diane Nestling. I'm with the East Timor Action Network. I live at 9625 Northwest Roseway in Portland, Oregon. And I've been involved in this effort for about 5 years. Shall I proceed with my testimony? I think this is a really moral statement. Considering what we're doing in the Balkans right now, East Timor has been going on for 23 years. And we have been ignoring it as a world. The UN has not recognized Indonesia's occupation of East Timor. I have to correct the administrator when he said that Indonesia took over the Portuguese colony. They never did officially. They invaded it, and they said they took it over, but the UN and America have never recognized that. And the media has never acknowledged this, and it's been virtually ignored. A third of people have been killed in this process, and in this last week, there's been a tremendous civil unrest in the territory. And a lot of this is because the Indonesian military has been arming the rural population with armaments supplied by the U.S., and there is tremendous unrest in the territory. And what we want is just for people to vote what they want to do, and for that to be acknowledged by the UN and to be enforced, and for the world to get on with this problem, because it's been going on for too long. The world has acknowledged it's a problem with the Nobel Peace Prize given to Bishop Bello and Joseph Lasorta. He was in town in Portland on Saturday. Saturday was a tremendous day of problems in East Timor. There was a massacre. the Capitol was invaded by paramilitary organizations, and in Portland we had the honor of hearing the Nobel Peace Laureate tell us the message of peace. He told us that the people of the resistance were not fighting. They were under a peace verdict. The armed paramilitary were fighting, were killing people, were slaughtering these two Marines, and the resistance were doing peace. And I just want to, that's my message here, that we want to have the people vote for peace, for what they want to do. They've been fighting for 23 years, and they've been suffering enough. Thank you.
Chairperson Simmons and members of the Committee of Rules, Elections, and Public Affairs, my name is William Seaman. I live at 2105 Southeast Taylor in Portland, Oregon. I'm the coordinator of the East Timor Action Network in Portland, Oregon. We have over 600 people that regularly receive our mailings here in Oregon and in Southern Washington. And we organize lectures and film programs and other educational events around East Timor. Sadly, it's a situation, as Diane and others have mentioned, that very few people in this country hear about, in spite of the very intimate relationship that our country has with the state of Indonesia. The situation today in East Timor is dire. As the previous speakers have mentioned, there has been a tremendous upsurge of violence, and in spite of the reports today in the Oregonian indicating a kind of a peace accommodation between the paramilitaries that have been armed and abetted by the Indonesian military and the pro-independence forces, there's still a genuine and very concrete concern that this violence could continue. And as mentioned already, dozens have been killed just in the previous days. I want to indicate also that we shouldn't be unrealistic about the impact of this kind of legislation. Recently declassified documents indicate that when U.S. personnel, diplomatic personnel, met with Augusto Pinochet, the former dictator of Chile, the number one topic was legislation pending in Congress having to do with the human rights situation under the dictatorship in Chile at that time. So whether it's selective purchasing laws that are passed by states such as that in Massachusetts, which target the Burmese military, or divestment activism targeting the former apartheid government in South Africa, or today's legislation facing the Oregon State Legislature, this legislation actively supporting self-determination for East Timor, be assured that the people who are implicated in this kind of legislation, they take notice. So when there are dozens of calls to the Indonesian embassy in Washington, D.C., they take notice that when a state passes this kind of legislation, they not only take notice, they take action. And that is what is necessary right now, because in spite of the very hopeful statements on the part of the Indonesian government that they would recognize an independent East Timor after 23 years of violence, illegal occupation, nonetheless, on the ground in East Timor, the military is sending a very different message to the people in East Timor, and it's a very violent and bloody message. So we are at a dramatic moment in the history of East Timor. We have an opportunity now to right a terrible historical injustice. And I think what was mentioned, I'll close finally with a particular terrible crime that occurred just this last weekend. A young man, 18 years old, the son of a former governor of East Timor, was sheltering dozens of refugees, women and small children, in their home. He was on the phone to his aunt in Australia, and his aunt urged him, please leave, get out while you can. And he said, how can I leave these children and these women in our home? I need to stay here to protect them. The next that they heard, he had been killed by these paramilitaries. This young man, for his bravery, was murdered in cold blood. This is not an academic question. This is very concrete, and it's happening today. This legislation can make a difference. I urge you to support this legislation. Thank you very much for hearing this testimony today. If I can answer any questions, I'd be happy to.
Thank you very much, Mr. Brian. Any questions from members of the committee? Professor Matt?
I fully support what you're trying to do here. My only question is, what would your position be if we amended it to eliminate the sending of a delegation, but simply ask the governor ask our officials to forward this proclamation or this resolution to the appropriate authorities on behalf of the legislative assembly?
I can give you my particular outlook on this. My feeling is that a statement, of course, would be a tremendous contribution, but that actively lobbying on behalf of the East Timorese in Washington and at the United Nations would be an even greater contribution.
Okay. Further questions of the committee? Thank you very much for coming today. We'll now call Michael Kerrigan, and David Bowman would be willing to come forward with him. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you. Chairman Simmons, members of the committee, my name is Michael Kerrigan. I live at 1439 West 4th in Eugene, and I represent Oregon Peace Force, the statewide peace and justice group based here in Salem. I'm speaking today in favor of House Joint Resolution 81. The people of the state of Oregon, especially our public officials, have a long-standing concern for human rights both in our local communities and in other parts of the world. There's much to be concerned about these days. In Springfield yesterday, an unknown assailant fired on students at the Douglas Garden Elementary School with a BB gun. And, of course, we all know about the terrible tragedy that just happened in Colorado. 14 Americans are united in the belief we must do all we can to protect our students from violence. But there are children who are victims of violence in other parts of the world who need our help as well. Oregonians are aware of what's happening, I think, in Yugoslavia, but most people don't know what's happening in East Timor. I have an intern from North Salem High School, very sharp and aware young woman, who didn't know about East Timor when I talked to her about it this afternoon. She does now because of, she read the testimony I was giving to you today. So you have an opportunity to educate the citizens of this state about what's happening in East Timor and to help bring a peaceful and just resolution to the conflict there. Will said, times are tough there. I won't repeat what he said. The Joint Resolution 81 promises to provide the means for a serious and productive contribution to achieving peace there in East Timor. It'll send a clear message to the government of Indonesia. We mean business in Oregon about human rights in East Timor. Finally, also, JR 81 will send a message to Congress and the State Department that they need to do more of the pressure of the Indonesian government. Clearly, the members of the Oregon Congressional Delegation are going to stand up and take notice if you send something, either a delegation or a statement of support to them. It's going to carry a great, great impact. Finally, there's bipartisan support on this in terms of the sponsors of the bill here and in Congress for supporting human rights in East Timor. So I urge your bipartisan support for joining Resolution 81. It will make a difference. Thank you. Thank you for letting me speak today. I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Kerrigan? Thank you, Mr. Kerrigan.
Thank you.
Mr. Bowman.
Chairman Simmons, members of the committee, my name is David Bowman. I live at 222 Southwest Pine, Portland, Oregon. I won't repeat what you've already heard today. I told people where I was coming today, almost no one knew or ever heard of East Timor, except for a few people who I had discussed with earlier in the week and in past weeks. I think this is a tragedy that people don't know that in the past 23 years, 200,000 people have been killed in East Timor and that people don't know about this. I think this is a great tragedy. I think that we can change this and raise awareness and get something done by passing to this resolution. There are a lot of people in the state of Oregon who know, people in this country and the world who know that Oregonians stand for human rights. Last weekend I had the opportunity to hear from Jose Ramos Horta, man of peace and nonviolence. I think I greatly respect, and I think that we should support him in his effort to bring about a peaceful solution to the crisis that is happening in East Timor. That's all I can say right now. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Is media being repressed in East Timor?
From what I'm aware, yes, it is.
And Indonesia then is not allowing
people are at great risk for reporting. There's been, from my understanding, reporters have been killed in East Timor for reporting on the situation.
Thank you very much. further questions from the committee? I represent Mack.
I'm totally sympathetic. The question we've been discussing on the sidebar here today, a couple of us did not go to the reception today because we didn't feel that it would be appropriate to do it for the representative of the Chinese government, considering the situation in Tibet. We didn't make a big deal out of it, we just didn't go. And my question is, how do we ferret out the situations where we would like the state of Oregon as legislative assembly to make a statement, send a delegation, and try to select appropriate circumstances? And because I'm totally sympathetic to the position presented today. I've already read the testimony that I missed before I came in here. And yet, Tibet comes to mind right off the bat, talking about Rwanda. Where do we, how do we select the situations where we're going to make a thing? Now, David, I will add quickly that if the legitimate is selected on the basis of the interest of a particular member of the assembly who brings this to our attention and brings folks in and works the issue and says, I have this cause, a legitimate cause, and will you help me with it? Do you have any suggestion for how we might approach that? And again, I guess you do what you can, where you can, when you can, and so that's not an excuse for inaction. It's a question as to how we get to be more proactive about this within limits, since we are here to do a lot of other business for the people, too. That's a very broad question. Perhaps you could just help me a little bit with that.
Chairman Simmons, Representative Mannix, I think the fact that we're here today asking you that, you know, is one, you know, a good reason for moving forward is I think you should use some of all the countries you mentioned. But people have to come forward and do that. But the fact that we're here today, I think Nietzsche should move forward with this. I also, Tibet Active is very concerned about that. And really support what you did today, not going to that luncheon today. I hope someone comes forward to this committee. It's probably too late in the process now. But I think it would have been a good idea to do it for all those countries.
Did you want to respond to
this? I was going to say that also, you know, that there are a lot of tragedies in the world, and it would be great if we could speak out against all those and raise issues about them in this way, but that hasn't been proposed yet, and this one has, so I'm coming here to support this one, and hopefully in the future when other resolutions are brought forward, I can come and support those also.
Yeah, that's true. I think that's a legitimate response, and I think that in my Judiciary Committee on Criminal Law, when we're dealing with a particular issue to improve the justice system, some of those saying, well, yeah, that's all well and good, but what about this, and what about that, and what about the other? My response is always, well, when I build a house, I build it a brick at a time. You've got this brick in front of me, I'll use this brick. I'll try to use the other bricks as soon as I get to them, but at least you do what you can where you can.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that sort of answers the question, and maybe it raises a larger question for later about us trying to set up a process where we can invite more people in without overburdening the system, which is legitimate. Counterpoint is at some point we are not the United Nations or the U.S. Congress, and we do represent the people of the state. We have to do a lot of other things for them, but it is appropriate for us to have a world view, too. I appreciate that, and I appreciate the time, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Colleagues, we also have a written testimony from a James Ridley submitted to our record today. Further questions of the committee? Seeing none, thank you very much, gentlemen, for coming down today. Anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on HCR 81?
Yes, one.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Peg Kerr. I'm representative for the afternoon testifying for myself today. Last May, my husband happened to be in Indonesia when the revolution started. East Timor is one of the more far-flung provinces, and the minority, the Javanese, control the government. East Timorese are very looked down upon. They are a racial minority. To Representative Nash's question about how they decide, in Indonesia, the government and military is very heavily supported by the United States, both in training and in weapons and probably direct funding I don't even know about. I think that's one of the things you consider. And when the revolution in Java started in April and May of last year, the president sent ex-Vice President Mondale to help settle it because Indonesia is so economically, commercially, so closely tied the United States, even though we don't often think of that, and it's militarily timed. So in answer to your question, I think that direct U.S. involvement, militarily and financially, is one way you make that decision. Thank you.
Questions from the committee? Thank you very much for coming in. Representative Merkel, will you step back up to the witness stand for a moment? Representative Devlin has a quick question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Merkley, a similar question has been asked before, but since there seems to be some discussion of the issue of a delegation, would it be fair to say that what you are looking for would be that the governor would extend from the discretionary funds he has enough funds to send to the free people for a week, 4 or 5 week-long period to communicate this message?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Devlin. I envision that it would be up to the governor, but my impression of this sort of thing would be that he would send 2 to 3 people for probably 2 nights, one in D.C. and then traveling to New York and then returning back.
I just wanted to get that on the record.
I'd like to also respond to the question Representative Mannix raised. And I can tell you that there are a long list of challenges in the world that's probably worthy of us making a comment on. The reason I didn't bring a long list to this legislature, however, is that I felt that the longer the list, the less the impact. And furthermore, most places in the world at most times, there is not a moment in which the door is open for a message to be heard. But we have this very rare situation where Indonesia, having long been a dictatorship, is now struggling with democracy, where they are struggling economically and seeking in the aid of the West, and particularly of the U.S. through an aid package from the International Monetary Fund. And so we have a particular moment in which they are ready to think about these issues, as enunciated by President Habibie of Indonesia, that they are thinking about whether and how to let East Timor go. We need to say at this particular moment, yes, we are glad you are thinking about that, and we think it's important, and we care about that, and it's the right thing to do, and in our relationship in helping you with your economy, we also want you to help the East Timorese people be freed from this terrible yoke of oppression that they have been under the last 24 years. And so that's why I chose this particular issue, and also because quite frankly, there were folks in Oregon who were suggesting that it was worth considering.
Thank you very much, Senator Mosley. I'll close the public hearing on HCR 81 and open a work session on HCR 81.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Mack.
I move that we send HCR 81 to the floor with a due pass.
Colleagues, there's a motion before us to move HCR 81 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so moved. We'll close the work session, HCR 81. And we had HCR 42 and HCR 61. We'll reopen the recess. Previously, a recess work session on HCR 42. And call Mr. Randy Tucker. We are under a little bit of a time constraint this afternoon.
Mr. Chair, I'll be quick. First, I'll introduce myself. My name is Randy Tucker. I'm with 1,000 Friends of Oregon. And I understand because there will be amendments, I'll just be general in my comments. 1,000 Friends of Oregon, as I believe you all know, is a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization with over 5,500 members across the state. We work on behalf of sound land use planning. And I'm here to express our opposition to Senate Joint Resolution 42, at least in the form... House Joint Resolution 42, at least in the form that I've seen it in, the original printed form, which would amend the Constitution to create a new process for rejecting administrative rules. To my reading, it resembles, at least in its outcome, ballot measure 27, which was defeated by the voters by about a 3-to-1 margin in 1996, and slightly less similar to ballot measure 65, which was defeated by the voters last fall by about a margin of about 50,000 votes. The voters have rejected proposals a couple of times that would create a new process for overturning administrative rules in the legislature. And in our view, on the most fundamental level, it's because this would be completely unnecessary. Administrative rules can be adopted only using procedures that are spelled out in statute, and by law must be consistent with the statute that they are adopted to implement. Public notice is required. Anyone can participate in the rulemaking process. And once they're adopted, there are already several ways for people to challenge those rules that they don't like or that they believe violate the or are inconsistent with the underlying statute. They can ask the legislature to throw those rules out. The legislature can change the rules by passing a law, or the people can run an initiative to change the law, of course. If the legislature or anyone else believes that the agency has adopted a rule that exceeds its authority, they can challenge it in court under the provisions of ORS 183-400, and they can also use a special process that was established by the legislature a few years ago for challenging administrative rules, and that's in ORS 183-720. And I will provide some written testimony for you, which gives you this information, but right now I'm working off of some notes, so I apologize for that. There was testimony earlier in the session on the Senate side from legislative counsel that described how the process of reviewing administrative rules by the legislative counsel committee works and how rarely it is that there is a conflict between the statute and the rule, and how those conflicts are generally resolved without any kind of a big conflict or a controversy, and when there is no resolution in the legislature, then passes legislation to clarify. We're concerned, obviously, because of the legislative rules that implement the Oregon Land Use Planning Program. We understand that many of those rules are controversial, but we believe that the way to address those would be in the legislature with full public process rather than in the interim at the request of just a few people, if I understand the process that Representative Sunseri described earlier. And I'll stop my comments right there, Mr. Chair, and we'll take a look at the amendments and come back.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Tucker?
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Oh, may I one more comment related to the last bill? I thank you for passing that. On a personal note, my sister lives in Indonesia and has worked for a long time on behalf of human rights in Indonesia and also education and democratic development there. And so I'm just personally acquainted a little bit with the situation. She spent a lot of time in East Timor, and appreciate your passing that measure out.
Mr. Padaki?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will be brief. For the record, I am David Sedanke, Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon. Our concerns about House Joint Resolution 42 as introduced have to do with both the merits of the original proposal and its potential constitutional problems. And I wanted to particularly point out a potential procedural issue prior to your consideration of amendments. There is nothing more fundamental to the protection of freedom than the separation of powers between the three branches of government. That was intended to be the primary bulwark of liberty in our federal constitution, as well as in each of the state constitutions. And some of you may be aware that at the federal level, they originally did not have a Bill of Rights included, because they felt that the separation of powers and the limited scope of the federal government would adequately protect liberty for the citizens of the United States. Here in Oregon, of course, we do have a Bill of Rights. We have had from the beginning. But the provision that H.R. 42 would amend is also a critical protection for liberty in Oregon. And I want to just quickly read you the existing Section 1 of Article 3 of the Oregon Constitution. The powers of the government shall be divided into three separate departments, the legislative, the executive, including the administrative, and the judicial. And no person charged with the official duties under one of these departments shall exercise any of the functions of another, except as expressly provided in this Constitution. The procedural issue I want to bring to the committee's attention is that the ACLU believes that because this section of the Constitution is so fundamental to the system of government, that any modification of it may be considered a revision of the state constitution. As the committee may be aware, a revision of the Constitution can only be placed on the ballot by the legislature and can only be approved by a two-thirds margin. So we would encourage the committee to seek an opinion from legislative counsel regarding the upcoming amendments as to whether or not there is a significant risk that those amendments might be considered a constitutional revision, thereby requiring a supermajority in order to pass the legislature.
Questions for Mr. Pedanke? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Liz Frankel.
Thank you very much. I'm Liz Frankel, representing the League of Women Voters of Oregon, which, as you know, is a statewide nonpartisan organization. The League has publicly opposed, and the League has two arms. One is educational and one is action. And we keep them very carefully separate. We did take positions on both about measures in 1996 and in 1998 in opposition to the rules measure. The only thing I can add to what you've already heard is a very interesting discussion I once heard from Dave Frommeyer, who is some lawyers know him as kind of the granddaddy of rules. And he was explaining why we needed rules, and he was going into elaborating a little bit on the fact that sometimes the rules were not what you liked, but that always depended upon your own particular point of view. And one of the difficulties you always have with rules is that sometimes you can be on the wrong end of them either way. And when the legislature, when it becomes as politicized as it does, when you refer to the legislature, one of the problems you sometimes get is that you may get what you asked for, but it wasn't quite what you intended. Depends on what the makeup of the legislature is. As has been noted before, there are means to deal with improper rules. If taken to court, you can go to the legislature. There is a process for reviewing that. The League will be very interested in seeing the amendments. I would add that I will turn in testimony, written testimony. I did not have an opportunity to hear it today. And thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you for coming today, and we will look forward to receiving that written testimony that you have for us.
Thank you.
Any questions for members of the committee? See none, we will close the public hearing on HCR 42 and reopen the recess public hearing on HCR 67, and we'll call Judge Carol Larson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Distinguished members of the committee, I really appreciate your saving me one more drive up here. I'd like to begin by quoting something that Judge David Brewer, who just was appointed to the Court of Appeals a short time ago and had his investiture down in Eugene, I think last week. In making some comments to that investiture, Judge Brewer said the following. Sometimes the legal profession and the judicial system look from the outside like a cabal of elitists who have too much power and too little regard for the lives and rights of others. It's tempting, in a world of snap judgments, rich from sound bites and incomplete information, to be too cynical about our justice system. I ask that you make your own judgments carefully, because on balance, there is no institution in our society that more zealously guards those rights than do the legal profession and the courts. We should and do insist on the right to disagree with the courts and to evaluate their judgments critically. However, the independence of the judicial system from the whims of political influence is fundamental and precious to our freedom. If judges are ever reluctant to follow the law because of fear of being unpopular or losing office, then we have all lost our rights. In return, the courts must be open, honest, accountable, and must shun intemperance and arrogance. These are the commitments we have to make in return. Speaking for myself, I would contend that there are a number of reasons which should make any person who cherishes the freedoms we enjoy in this great state and country to think long and hard before supporting legislation such as that proposed by H.J.R. 67. This legislation will have the effect of forcing all judges to be constantly on the prowl for campaign funds for the next election. No person who has forsaken a hard-won and valuable legal career as a top-flight lawyer to accept public service as a judge could afford to go into an election without actively campaigning against a candidate named none of the above. Do you want to be a litigant in a court system where judges must think about the mantra of the 90s, show me the money? Even if a judge in such a system possesses the fortitude and high moral character and principle to be truly fair and completely independent, won't the suspicion of potential corruption ultimately be just as pernicious and perhaps more so to the public respect for the justice system as its actual existence? There are time-worn and very sound reasons why it is considered unethical for a judge to engage in that which is improper or even that which has the appearance of impropriety. I suggest that the constant need to raise money for campaign funds lends itself to the latter. This bill would have the effect of requiring judges to raise $50,000 to run against themselves, and potentially much more if there's a candidate. This legislation also plays into the hands of any small disgruntled group or individual who may be inclined, for whatever reason, to finance a last-minute stealth campaign against a particular judge who happens to be unopposed. Several thousand dollars worth of well-placed media ads could unseat the best and fairest judge in the state in the absence of a substantial fundraising and serious campaigning done by that judge, even though there wasn't really any opposition. The true character and real agenda of such persons or groups might well be completely unseen and unknowable to the voters. This is antithetical to the openness of Oregon elections. This legislation is likely to make it much harder to attract the best and brightest legally trained and experienced persons to the bench. Who will want to give up the personal investment of many years of an established practice or position to go to the judiciary, worry about the political impact of every decision you make every time you walk into that courtroom, and campaign full-time to merely be looked upon as a pawn of the highest bidder, whether true or not? No person in the right mind would opt for that kind of a position. The end result is likely to be a much younger, less experienced, and less capable judiciary. We should encourage judges to make good, albeit oftentimes very difficult, decisions. Politicizing the judicial process is not very likely to encourage citizens' respect for the judicial system, or, I fear, for government in general, not to mention the legislature in particular. I suggest that this idea to add none of the above to the ballot for judges is no better an idea for judges than it would be for legislators. On behalf of the people of Oregon who cherish the importance of a truly independent and fair-minded judiciary, I respectfully request that you reject this bill as very unsound and unwise. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Judge Larson. Any questions for Judge Larson?
I have a question, Mr.
Chairman. Yes, Mr. Edwards.
I appreciate your testimony today. You raise an interesting question about the politicization of the judicial branch. You're suggesting that money does that, and some can make that link us in any branch that there's an election. But even if true, though, even if joining, there is politics in the judicial branch, i.e., if you're appointed by an elected official. So I'm not sure what, you know, say there's no politicization of any appointed position as well is I'm extrapolating to that conclusion. Isn't that true as well? Are you going to take your argument out for the next set?
Well, I suppose I can speak to some extent on behalf of other judges, but I quite frankly prefer to speak on behalf of myself. I do that. I've been a judge for 9 years now. I was a prosecutor for 18. I was originally appointed to the bench by Neil Goldschmidt and was then elevated to the circuit court by the present governor. I guess I have the feeling, first of all, that the appointment by a governor of me to that particular position was done, at least I like to think, because he felt like at the time I was the most qualified candidate who would do the fairest job of being impartial in my decision making and view everybody's position and then make the decision that was dictated by the law or the facts, or at least to make a good policy choice based upon what I heard in court. And the fact that we all know that judges tend to be unopposed, I think is sort of a moral support for your being able to remain independent. People recognize on sort of a gut level that judges have to make hard decisions, and they may not like the particular decision that's made, but I think one of the things I've noticed in being a judge is when I walk into a room to talk to any public body, I don't really have to, as a public official, try to create my own credibility. The judiciary still, remarkably, has that ability to carry the respect of people for the position of being a judge. Now, I'm sure that you've all had experiences in your legislative capacity where that wasn't the case, whether justified or not. And I think that that's a very tenuous thing that we hold on to in our society. And if we do things in the process from motivations that could be the best and destroy that very tenuous, fragile commodity, we will have done something that will undo respect for law across the board in this country. And I think this is just one of those pieces of legislation. When I make decisions, quite frankly, under the current system, I know that some of those decisions are more political than others, but I feel like I can make them. And if I have to campaign on those issues, I can do that. But that I sort of understand that I have the ability to make that decision and try to do the best I can.
Colleague, it is 4:30. I'm happy to go ahead and continue finishing testimony and asking questions of this judge, this witness, if she'd be so desired to do so, and then we'll get on to the floor as soon as we finish the sense of the committee. Okay, let's take Representative Welsh first.
Mr. Chair and Judge Larson, it's good to see you today. I just want the committee members to know that Judge Larson has been one of those that has worked with me and with other legislators. He's one of our finest from down in Wayne County. And we've worked on a number of different issues in the past.
Yeah.
And he's helped us, and he's been very objective. And I just really appreciate him. I think if we knew judges, like I know each and every one, you probably do, but we always like to protect a lot of those from our own area. But Judge Larson, don't you think this is some of, there's always been this kind of contention between the legislature and the judgeships, and some of this concern has really developed when we see maybe some decisions that are encroaching on a policy coming from maybe decisions from the judgeship, and we have a real problem with that, or some of our constituents do, and that is what develops. There's a joint resolution like this that is asking for maybe some accountability.
Well, you know, what is policy and what is law is, I can tell you from the perspective I've got, is pretty gray area. And if we just think back about Brown versus Board of Education, it's pretty easy to say, well, that was judicial-made law, it was policy, you know, they made a policy decision. Well, yes, but equal protection is a pretty important commodity in our country. And what's happened thereafter is perhaps the legislative process and the executive branch decided to put some teeth behind what probably should have been done long before. And we're not done with that yet. But sometimes there can be reasonable differences in opinions about what is policy and what is law. But I think that fragile commodity that I'm talking about, of constant respect for the law, once it's made, if that needs to be changed legislatively, then that can be done. But the process of making a hard decision is one that I think we all want to hang on to. And I wouldn't want to do anything to change that, either from my current position or if I was in your seat. My feeling would be exactly the same.
Representative Breyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To your position currently, aren't you an elected official?
I am.
So to say that you have to run against no one, how is that going to corrupt the system more than it's already corrupt when you have to stand for election as it is?
Well, put yourself in that position. You don't have a declared candidate on the day of filing, and you're moving into the election. Your job, quite frankly, is dramatically different than mine. Your job is to make policy decisions, to make the law. Mine is to try to interpret what it is that you've written down and make sure that it gets applied.
And may I clarify, what is the, currently someone can file for an against you. So what I take it your statement to be that if you are running unopposed, you can be pure and pristine, but if you're running against someone, then you can't. But currently, someone can run against you, can't they?
Sure they can, and if somebody files, I know that months in advance, and I'm able to do what I need to do to raise the money to at least present myself in a reasonable way to the public. There are lots of things I can't do. I can't speak freely about a lot of things for very good reasons. But in a situation like this, Justice Gillette mentioned a couple days ago at another hearing that a no vote packs a lot more wallets than a yes vote. And this is a classic example of that being true. How many people, one of the things that was expressed by Representative Sinceri is how difficult it is for people to know truly about what's going on with a particular judge or all the judges. How much more difficult would it be for a judge to run against none of the above? I mean, this afternoon I heard coming up here that the American public now, at a 60% rate, has ever heard of Kosovo. In light of all the stuff that's gone on, 60% have heard of Kosovo. Can you imagine what the problem would be for a judge who they've never heard of you? What could you do? You'd have to raise a lot of money to present yourself so they even knew who you were, and then try to run against none of the above. I mean, apathy alone could defeat every judge. I just don't think that's a very fair way to do this, or a very sensical way to approach either the judiciary or other offices.
Okay, then on that line, what about the process of rather than, if we're going to change something, where rather than the judges run for election, they'd be appointed by a governor and confirmed by the Senate?
Well, I testified about that several days ago.
I apologize, I didn't.
That was at the Senate Rules Committee. I didn't type that out because I didn't even know I was supposed to be there to talk about that at the time. But I'd be happy to respond to that in writing and basically relate to you what I said then and what others said then. It seems to me that the system we've got is working really pretty well. And I'd be reluctant to change that. That is a system that could, in fact, be done. It's oftentimes called the Missouri Plan. And I think Justice Gillette was right on target when he says, even Missouri doesn't have the Missouri Plan. There are probably good reasons for that. It is a political process to go through the part about being appointed. But it seems to me that governors are not inclined to appoint somebody who's going to be a lousy candidate for the position. And the quality, speaking for myself, the quality of the other people that are in that pool, I would have been hard-pressed to say that everyone that was in the pool with me wasn't absolutely qualified for the job. And there's a self-selecting process. You couldn't even get to that point unless you were really qualified for the job.
Thank you, Mr. Manning. Thank you, Mr. Manning. Yeah, here, I'll turn the hard way. You're this far down on the end of the committee, Your Honor. I appreciate having you here today. And as the only member, I guess, of the bar who's currently here on the committee today, I want to say first off that I have nothing but the highest respect for the judges that serve both at the circuit court level and in our appellate courts in the system. And I would oppose proposal because of, I think, the far-reaching implications that it could have. But I will say
that I do believe that the process by which Oregon judges are selected is a political process. And the difference between its process and any other political process is it's primarily a process that involves only one branch, and that's the politics of the executive branch. And while I have not publicly voiced support, and will still not do so for the proposal of Senate confirmation, I think it's an appropriate thing that this legislature look at the history of judge selection in this state. I don't think, at least in my opinion, I have no qualms with the quality of the judges that have been selected, but I think it's an appropriate thing for us to examine. And I think whether or not we at some point go to some sort of a judicial commission, which, you know, creates a panel of judges that a governor then might choose from, or some other method, that it would help, quite frankly, to have a greater level of openness in the process. And right now it's a little bit Byzantine, I think, would be the appropriate word for everybody who is not either within the legal system and knows about the bar review that goes on in the recommendation. If you're outside the legal system, I think the how judges come to power and get their office in Oregon is somewhat Byzantine for the average citizen, and there ought to be something we can do to make it more open. But I would reject this proposal, and let me say again, and I know I'm taking time out of what we're supposed to be doing right now, Mr. Chairman, but I don't want any of those comments to reflect in any way, shape, or form any discredit to the judicial system of this state, because I do believe it's one of the finest judicial systems of any state in the Union, and I think we ought to be proud of the work that our judges do.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for being here today. The question I have is in the realm of the election of judges. Do you believe that it's healthy when we do have races between judges, or we do have somebody that does actually file? We do have a race?
I'm not opposed to the elective system for judges. I think that that can be healthy. I think the very fact that that there is the risk of your being opposed is healthy. It lends a significant, constant reality check to what you're doing. One of the things that I think happens in the federal judiciary is when you're appointed for life, you really aren't responsible to anyone. And there are lots of lawyer jokes about the arrogance of the judiciary, only to be exceeded possibly, maybe, by God, but unlikely so, isn't far from the truth. And it seems to me that the process of electoral process for judges can be healthy. One possible interpretation of the fact that there aren't that many judges that have opposition is because people recognize that they're probably doing a pretty good job.
The questions from the committee.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I really appreciate you taking me out of order today.
Okay, we will recess and we will call Mr. Coy and Mr. Jager. Can you guys stick around? You gentlemen stick around? It's 6 o'clock. We'll be here. Okay. There are amendments coming to the bill. I think the Sincerity noted. And we are already about 12 minutes late for a function that we are all going to ask for. We'll recess the public hearing on HCR 67 and recess the committee hearing. Mm-hmm.